From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Is a jobless recovery not a recovery after all? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Healthcare reform in Afghanistan are getting the headlines, but President Obama's biggest challenge could be creating jobs. Unemployment's at 9.8%, the highest in more than 25 years. Full employment isn't likely again until 2017. We'll hear what it's like to get laid off and how hard it is to get rehired. What happened to that economic stimulus money? What can the government do now? Instead of promoting a quick fix, should the focus be on new jobs with long-term usefulness to American society? Wermin Alney back with To the Point. The U.S. economy needs 100,000 new jobs every month just to keep up with the growth in population. Instead, more than 200,000 a month are disappearing. The average rate of unemployment is now 9.8%, and it's rising. How long will it take for the economy to replace all those lost jobs? And where will the new jobs come from? Those are questions raised by Sudeep Reddy, who writes about the economy for the Wall Street Journal. It's always good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
How do you answer those questions?
Well, there are two issues that we need to look at. One is how many jobs will have come back just as the economy recovers. There are some employers, obviously, who have been cutting jobs as demand dropped. And so some of those, whether they're working in restaurants or answering phones somewhere, are going to have to come back just as people start buying things, as demand picks up. The other issue, though, is we've heard so many times that this has been the deepest and longest recession since the Great Depression, and we've been feeling the pain of it over the last 2 years. But what's often forgotten is how much longer we're going to feel the pain of it, and that's just eliminating this employment gap that's going to be so difficult. We've lost 7 million jobs. Probably by the time we're done with the job losses, it'll be over 8 million in terms of the total number. And so just filling those jobs, that's the deepest contraction in the labor market since the Great Depression, and filling those jobs is going to take a very long time. You don't just bounce back from something like that, because employers are slow to hire. They were slow to hire after the last recession, and they're proving slow to hire now.
How long will it take? I've heard the year 2017 mentioned as the earliest that we could replace those jobs.
Well, it all depends on how quickly the economy grows. If we were to see growth in the labor market as we saw in the 1990s, which was twice as fast as this expansion over this current decade, then it would still take a very long time. That's where that 2017 number comes from. Depending on which figures you use, some have said even 2019, just to get back to the prior 5% unemployment rate, given the jobs that we've lost and how long and all the jobs that would be need to be created, a million a year, just to keep up with the labor force growth. So it's a long time. It's certainly possible that we could have some phenomenal growth that would speed that up. That would obviously be the goal in all of this, is to figure out a way to grow the economy faster to speed that up. But the picture is just not very good right now.
One of the things being talked about today, it's been talked about since Obama took office, but now resurrected, is the idea of the government providing tax credits to employers that create jobs. What are the pros and cons of that idea?
Well, that's been one of the areas that's been debated so much, because job growth is the ultimate goal of a stimulus package, and if there's some way you can create jobs out of a stimulus package, then that's what you want to do. But with something like a tax credit for employers to hire, some employers are going to hire anyway, and so it's really difficult to sort out who's hiring because of a government benefit and who's hiring otherwise. Would some businesses, small businesses, be able to kind of shift their books around to make it seem like they're hiring just to get this tax break? And so there could be some merit in offering a business tax break, and that's probably going to get some discussion, whether it's this particular form. One of the reasons it hadn't come in already is because it's so controversial in how it would be structured, and there are other ways that you might be able to boost consumer spending that would offset the high unemployment.
I've heard it suggested that companies could shut down and then go back into business claiming that they were creating new jobs. Would it be possible to stop that?
Well, there are certain. It all depends on how you structure a program like that. You could certainly say that any jobs that any net jobs that were created after a certain date would be at So if you were to go below the number at that date, then those jobs wouldn't count if they were coming in after that point. So there are a lot of different ways you could set this up, and there have certainly been a number of proposals that are out there to do something like this. It's just we kind of saw this debate with cash for clunkers and also with the credit for new homeowners, and it's what are we really doing here in terms of stimulating new demand? What are we doing that wouldn't have happened otherwise? Some people would have bought cars otherwise. Some people would have bought homes otherwise, and so we may not be able to be actually creating something new out of this, just moving the pieces around.
You mentioned the stimulus package. There's been talk about another stimulus package or extending the current stimulus package. How likely is that? What kind of effect might it have?
Well, it's certainly possible, and we saw earlier in this year when the stimulus package was being debated, a lot of people out there, a number of economists, said that maybe $800 billion isn't enough. This is such a deep recession, and this is such a big hole that needs to be filled, that maybe we need more than $800 billion, or maybe we need it spread out over a longer period of time, given how deep that hole is. Now, getting something like that passed then was going to be difficult. Getting something significant passed now is going to be even more difficult, given the figures we're seeing with the deficit and the debt and a lot of the political backlash against it. But so much of the stimulus just hasn't even gone out the door yet. And so we're going to see later this year, probably into the first half of next year, half of the stimulus money coming in, and it's obviously going to be creating some construction jobs because a lot of the money goes toward that. There's still some tax breaks embedded in the stimulus money. And so the early discussions are starting right now. A lot of them are around extending unemployment benefits. The highest unemployment benefits rate right now is for people who have lost their jobs to go up to 79 weeks of benefits, depending on the state, and that certainly could be extended out for some other folks who haven't qualified for it yet.
79 weeks is a long time for unemployment benefits. Has it ever been that long before?
I don't know that it has been that long, but this is certainly an unusual recession in its depth, and the number of people who are unemployed now for more than 6 months is also rising at a really quite concerning rate. You've got a third of the 15 million who are unemployed have been out of a job for more than 27 weeks, and so that's a big problem, and it leads to a lot of other concerns about whether skills atrophy, whether it is possible to get some of those people employed again, because a lot of employers, for various reasons, they kind of shy away from people who have been out of the labor market for a little while.
You mean they want to hire somebody that has never worked before?
Well, they generally want to hire some people who might be younger, and so people who are coming out of college into a weak job market are going to be cheaper to hire. And people who have been working more recently they might have a better shot at getting hired just because they have more recent work experience. And so the farther out you get, the harder it becomes.
Sudhi Pireddy, once again, economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Peter Goodman is national economics correspondent for The New York Times. He's author of Past Due, The End of Easy Money and the Renewal of the American Economy. Peter Goodman, always good to have you on our program.
Thanks very much.
You've been around the country a good deal. Tell us a bit, if you will, from an anecdotal perspective, where is it worst, and what kinds of situations are people feeling or facing, rather, that we don't hear that much about?
Well, it tends to be worst in the places where the housing bubble has been worst. So parts of California, Oregon, Nevada, Florida, and then, of course, in Arizona, and the industrial Midwest has been hit really hard. I mean, the industrial Midwest was hit hard during the so-called expansion before the recession hit. I mean, what I am accustomed to hearing more and more is people telling me that the basic promise of middle-class life seems to be assaulted. I mean, there's just this tremendous uncertainty amongst people who've been out of work a long time that they'll ever be able to work again, that they'll be able to send their children to college and save for retirement, let alone, or even just make, you know, next month's mortgage payment. There's just tremendous insecurity out there.
You've met a couple of people that you have described in various places. Tell us about the African-American woman who wanted to educate her daughters in good schools, moved to a good area, and then had some problems.
Yeah, this is a primary character in my book. There's a woman named Dorothy Thomas, and yeah, as you correctly say, I mean, she had gotten herself in trouble over a number of years because she was just insistent that her daughters were going to finish college. She had been sent to the first forcibly integrated school district in Oklahoma. She grew up in rural poverty in Oklahoma. So she, for years, she lived in these better neighborhoods in Northern California and paid some bills and didn't pay others, but managed to keep it together. And after her daughters were out of the house and off in school, she got pulled over by a cop one day in San Jose. She hadn't paid a $10 registration sticker on her car, and the officer had her car towed, and so she couldn't get to work. And she lost her job, and without a job, she couldn't pay her rent. And by the time I met her, she was living in this dilapidated house in Oakland that soon got foreclosed on, and she ended up in a homeless shelter. And she was daily taking the bus to this job center in Oakland, asking, is it even worth the bus fare to go and look for a job? As the unemployment rate was skyrocketing, and she was getting all these rejections, starting to get very insecure about her age. She was in her late 40s. She'd gained a few pounds. She talked about her frustration relying on food banks. And she said, yeah, you know, they keep giving us cakes and cookies. They don't give us nice produce there. And, you know, maybe it's that I can't afford to buy fancy shampoo and my hair doesn't look so good anymore. And she just started to lose her confidence and yet was still going out looking. And then she almost found a job, and she didn't get it because she failed a credit check, and more than a year went by, and she's still unemployed.
Do you think that's typical?
Well, I mean, that's a pretty extreme story. I mean, to go from she'd been earning $22 an hour in medical billing and ended up in a homeless shelter, that's certainly extreme. But what isn't extreme is the number of people who are one bad piece of news away from catastrophe. And that's very similar to Dorothy's situation. I mean, going into this recession, something like 45-46% of the country had liquid assets of $5,000 or less, which means, you know, you lose your job, you go through a divorce, you get sick. It doesn't take long to be in a position where you're wondering if you're going to be on the street.
Peter Goodman again, national economics correspondent for the New York Times. You mentioned that the basic promise of middle-class life may not be available to people who thought they had it. Ellen Hartnett is a resident of Minnesota now. She is currently employed in a temporary position as a clinical social worker, but that is very recent. She and her husband have gone through a long period of drastic change after moving from Minnesota to California with dreams of middle-class prosperity. Ellen Hartnett, good to have you on our program.
Hi, thank you.
Tell us a bit about yourself. You were in a relatively high income bracket. Your husband was a vice president, CEO of a firm. What happened?
Well, he was laid off in February after the company had moved us from Minnesota to California, and I'm speaking probably today more on as sort of the collateral damage of the spouse here. I gave up my career to move to California with him because this was such a great opportunity, and they moved us and paid us well, and we bought a house that we qualified for just on his salary in California, and was going to, for the first time in my life, not have to work for a year until I could find a job in California. And then he was laid off within 3 years of being there. And that was in February. And by about April, we really had to look at ourselves and look at our life in California. And we had to make some really hard decisions about whether we could, even if he got a job by April 1st, we were going to be so far behind, and our house would not sell because the market was going down. We had to look at where can we live the way we had, maybe not the way we were living in California or the way we had lived previously in Minnesota, but just live in a safe neighborhood in a house. And we just had to cut back, and the cost of living just is so much cheaper outside of California. And we had family and support systems back here. But it was very difficult to leave California. It was our dream at the time. We were very happy there. We built a community. It was very hard to say goodbye to our friends. I had found a job. it was not going to be a job that could sustain our living in California. So it worked out to be better to leave that job and so that we could live cheaper in Minnesota.
Both you and your husband are in your 50s, as I understand it. How's he doing finding a job?
Well, yeah, we're probably your typical NPR listeners. We both have college degrees and master's degrees. He's in technology, mostly in management in the later part of his years. He's 55. I'm 55. He's had, I think, about seven interviews of a sort, where there were maybe two of those interviews were actual jobs. He was one of two for a job that would have had to relocate us to Hawaii. But as we got closer to that job, the job kept changing, is what he discovered. And so they ended up deciding to go in an entirely different direction. And the other retained search job that he was very close to was to go back to his old company in California. And that obviously wasn't going to work. So it's been very disheartening. I think we cope with it in many different ways. You can't look for a job day in and day out every single day. You have to find things to keep your spirits up. Volunteering really helps.
Okay, we're going to hear more about that with Ellen Hartnett, Peter Goodman, Sudeep Reddy, and also Bradford Jensen at the McNonough School of Business at Georgetown University. We'll talk a bit about the global economy. On Reporter's Notebook, new developments in the argument over health care reform and the public option. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Marvin Olney back with To the Point, talking about the ravages of unemployment today from Peter Goodman at the New York Times. We heard about Dorothy Thomas, a woman who went from a middle-class job trying to put her daughters through college to living in a homeless shelter. We've heard from Ellen Hartnett directly, resident now of Minnesota, who had to give up a dream of living in California and now can't afford a house. Her husband doesn't have a job. Volunteer work, she just told us, may be a way to help to cope. Let me go back to Sudeep Reddy at the Wall Street Journal. Are these people in their 40s, in the case of Dorothy Thomas, in their 50s, in the case of Ellen Hartnett and her husband, who are likely to be able to find new jobs created by any sort of government program that is on the horizon?
It's certainly possible. There's government money going into a lot of areas, whether it's construction or energy technology, and that doesn't just require people with skills in those areas. It requires skills tied to those. But we've all heard stories about 300 people, 500 people applying for single job openings, sometimes well over 1,000 for a single one. And so it's just going to be that difficult while the economy is still losing jobs and employers overall aren't really hiring very much to see that get whittled down. Unemployment is widely expected to go above 10% and really stay above 10% for much of next year. It may be the second half of next year before we really see it start to come down, and that's one of the better, more optimistic scenarios, because there's so many people who have just dropped out of the search for a job that they're not even counted anymore. Once you get into that figure, it's obviously much higher, well above 16-17%. So it's going to take a long time before we even see any meaningful difference there.
Peter Goodman, back to you with the New York Times. When so many people are unemployed and it's an increasing number and they aren't able to participate themselves in the economy, what does that mean in terms of recovery?
Well, that's certainly a downward pressure on recovery. I mean, you want more people making more money and feeling like they can go out and spend money, which creates opportunities for businesses and gives business owners the sense that they can invest in adding equipment and coming out with new products and hiring more people. It becomes, you know, what economists refer to as a virtuous cycle. And as long as you have lots of people who are depressed and suffering forced austerity and wondering where their next paycheck is coming from, that certainly gets in the minds of a business owner or a bank, for that matter, that has to decide whether to lend money to a business. and just contributes to this overall sense of let's just wait and see.
And Sudeep Reddy, when so many people are unemployed, 79 weeks of unemployment may not be enough for many of them. But what does that do to the ability of the state and federal governments to provide assistance? And how soon is that going to run out?
Well, that obviously could keep getting extended at the federal level. The U.S. government is borrowing a lot just to keep that alive for a lot of people. State governments, of course, are as stretched as they've been in a very long time in terms of trying to having to balance their budgets and cut spending. And so you're not going to get very much more assistance from state governments. Really, the goal at the state level right now is to try to avoid much deeper cuts than we're already seeing in those jobs and those budgets. And so that is going to be really quite difficult. But the federal government could go on for a while, and you're seeing that with the Democratic leadership right now in Congress recognize that this is an unusual recession, and they're going to have to step up and provide some more funding if they don't want all those people to fall into even deeper trouble. And obviously all of this has implications for consumer spending and the overall economy. When you've got 10% unemployment, it's going to make the recovery, which you need to really get jump-started much more quickly, take a lot longer.
Ellen Hartnett, back to you. Now in Minnesota, after the California Dream went sour on you, what sort of unemployment assistance have you been able to get, and how dependent are you now on the public sector?
We're completely dependent on our unemployment. I have a temporary job that is helping to supplement, but it will run out, and I want to speak a little bit to Mr. Reedy's point. The skills atrophy issue is huge for us because of the technology field that my husband is in. The longer he's out of work and away from the technology and being older, he does face you just sort of have a feeling when you walk into the interview that they know you're going to be expensive because you're older. and that's not true. We would take a job for a whole lot less. Most of the jobs he has looked at is for a whole lot less. But that's sort of hard, and you think about little things like not letting your hair go gray before the job interview so that you can come across a little bit younger and a little more energetic. But when you're 55, it takes a lot of emotional energy to want to go in and apply for jobs that you know you could do but probably won't get hired for. So it's not just the California dream that's lost. It's having to be back competing with a lot of younger people and feeling like the brain drain out there is going to be really serious. I don't feel that far from Dorothy. I feel very fortunate that I've had a very good life and I'm not out of money yet, but it's just a matter of time until I am in Dorothy's position. Fortunately, I think I have a lot of family and friends that'll probably take me in before I'm in a shelter, but I'm meeting a lot of my friends that are this way too. So I think we're going to have an awful lot of people that are going to hit the 65-year mark if this goes out till, 2017. I'm going to be about 65 then. How am I going to collect my Social Security then if there isn't any, So those are things that I think about now.
Ellen Hartnett in Minnesota. Peter Goodman, back to you. Let's talk a bit about the possibility of creating new jobs and what kinds of jobs they ought to be. You pointed out earlier we have a consumer society. It's also said that we have a service economy and that we're too dependent on service sector jobs, and we've gotten away from jobs that actually do something or create something for a society. What's your take on that, and ought the government to be focused as it tries to create new jobs?
Yeah, I mean, I think the government's job is to try to make sure there's enough capital flowing into areas of research, largely through research institutions and also job training, to help catalyze growth in the sorts of industries that seem most promising in terms of delivering us new jobs. The obvious area to look, it's on everybody's radar, is renewable energy. I mean, we've got this intersection of concerns about climate change and the embracing of things like solar and wind power with the reality that this is now becoming a big business, and a lot of wind turbines are getting deployed across the country. These are big, heavy things to ship. Why not make them in the United States? Why not make them in the Rust Belt, where obviously there are a lot of skilled people who are out of work and are eager for the work? And in my book, I write about the town of Newton, Iowa, which lost Maytag, lost about 2,000 jobs when Maytag shut, in a town of about 16,000 people back in the fall of 2007. And they very carefully said, well, what can we do in this global economy? You know, what is our strength? We're on the Great Plains, the so-called Saudi Arabia of wind. Let's get some companies in here that are making the gear for wind power. And within a few months, they had about 700 jobs back making the blades for wind turbines in one factory and another making towers. Now, that's not, you know, a recipe, but that's an example of how one community said, what's our strength? Another in North Carolina, where a lot of furniture-making jobs have been lost, a lot of tobacco and textile jobs have been lost. The state funneled a lot of money through research institutions that are strong in the life sciences and created a biotech industry and set up a training program to help transition textile workers and tobacco workers into new entry-level jobs that actually pay quite a bit more in biotech. It's just important to remember that we retain a lot of skills and innovation in this country, and we just have to get our incentives straight so we're making them work for us.
Peter Goodman again with the New York Times. Bradford Jensen is an associate professor at the McDonough School of Business at Georgetown University. He's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for Economics as well, international economics, I should say. Bradford Jensen, good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
We hear a lot about textile jobs, a lot about manufacturing jobs, as we have already on this program, going overseas. And it is alleged that that outsourcing is one of the major problems with unemployment, and that the global economy is really making it more difficult for the United States to stay in business, as it were. What's your take on that?
I don't think that's the case. I think we need to be very careful about attributing the current high level of unemployment to globalization or international trade. I think we all should think back to 2 or 3 years ago, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, when we were having a very active debate about outsourcing, and the unemployment rate was 5%. So I think this trend of outsourcing and the movement of economic activity to where it can be done most efficiently has been going on for a long time, and it's not the source of the current high unemployment.
What is then?
I think it's we've had a very big financial crisis, a big shock to the system that's caused people to reevaluate their expectations about how secure is my job? Should I keep savings in the bank? I mean, prior to this past year, the personal savings rate in the United States was very low. And I think a lot of people, because of changes in expectations about risks of losing their job, are now saving a lot more. And that's going to cause a hit to demand, and it's going to take our economy a little while to readjust to the new level of demand.
Back to the issue, though, of the global economy. Not every town can recover the way Newton, Iowa did when Maytag went away. Can they? When that happens, doesn't it increase the when whole industries shut down? Look at the auto industry, for example. Or when jobs go overseas because they're cheaper, the labor's cheaper, the textile industry being prominent there. It seems counterintuitive to say that that doesn't increase unemployment.
Sure. In the short run, absolutely. These shifts in global production patterns can change unemployment in a particular region or in a particular industry. I do think we should be very careful, though, in attributing the loss of manufacturing jobs solely to globalization. What we've had is enormous productivity growth in manufacturing. U.S. workers producing more with fewer people, that has been a long-term trend in reducing the employment in manufacturing, but not the output in manufacturing. The United States, I think, is still the world's manufacturing leader, still produces the most manufacturing output of any country in the world, even though we have a relatively small share of population. So people confuse efficiency with job loss, and I think that that's dangerous. To your point about, you know, what can we do, the United States is still a relatively skilled, as I think it was Peter said, innovative place. And it's these types of activities that where we have comparative advantage. We are going to export high-skill, high-innovation activities and products, both services and products. I guess I would take exception with your statement that we need to get back to making things. I think that, you know, services are a very viable portion of the economy. They provide good, stable jobs. And I think that to unnecessarily focus on manufacturing in a policy sense is a mistake.
Peter Goodman, what do you say to that?
Well, I sort of come in between the two of you. I mean, I look at it like this. I think we need to get away from manufacturing fairy tales, which is essentially what we've done for the last decade plus. We've had financial services leading our economy to an unhealthy degree, manufacturing first the story that, you know, the internet was changing everything and made crazy stock valuations somehow rational, and therefore there was no limit on the amount of money we could borrow and then pump into these first dot-coms and then other tech businesses, which was really great until it wasn't. And then we built this fantasy that housing prices could never fall, and therefore there was no limit on how much we could borrow and invest in real estate and have consumers borrow against their homes and distribute that money throughout the economy. You know, that was really bad. It was bad when we became dependent upon coming up with excuses to make money change hands and then somehow calling that economic progress. And we've been listening too long to what Wall Street needs to prosper as if that's good for the nation. We've learned that there's a divergence often between, you know, what's good for people who work on Wall Street and what's good for the rest of us. And that does argue for getting back to making goods and services that are actually needed and intrinsically useful, where there's real demand. That probably does mean some more manufacturing jobs, though it doesn't mean we're going to be making tube socks in North Carolina. It means we're going to be making, you know, high-value, high-innovation, hard-to-ship goods like the tractors that Caterpillar makes in Peoria, Illinois, or these wind turbines I've talked about in Iowa. And it definitely means trying to figure out what we're good at and what's needed and building on that.
Professor Jensen, any argument with that?
Not the last part. Absolutely not. I wouldn't want to be an apologist for the dot-com bubble and the housing market bubble. But I do think, you know, Peter said, get back to producing goods and services that provide value. And I think that there is a large swaths of the service economy that do provide a lot of value, that do provide high-skilled workers with high-wage jobs that the U.S. can export.
What about education? It would seem to be very important in the kind of economy we're talking about for the future. But here's Ellen Hartnett. Both she and her husband have master's degrees. She's worried that he, working in a high-tech industry, is going to become obsolete very quickly. Bradford Jensen, how do you avoid that? Is there some way to continually educate yourself? And how difficult is that if you're unemployed?
I think that that's a real policy challenge. I think both for traditional students, you know, K-12 and college, we face big challenges in this country preserving our skill base and our innovative capacity. But then for continuing education, I do think that that is also a very large policy challenge, is how do we keep people on the frontier throughout their careers? I don't think that there are easy answers to that.
Let me go back to Sudeep Reddy with the Wall Street Journal. We often hear that what we really ought to be doing is buy American. Is there much of a sentiment in that direction now in Washington, and are we going to be hearing more of that in days to come?
There's some sentiment in certain corners of Washington, but the White House is certainly not pushing that line, and it's really not getting very much traction, despite a few lines coming up in the stimulus. There are plenty of people who realize that that could cause damage in the long run. And so you will start to see, though, to your earlier point, a lot more attention from a policy perspective on education, on training, and how to retrain workers. The particularly troublesome part of all of this is that a lot of people got the signal in the early 90s that they needed to be trained in computer technology and programming, and some of them went into that area, and we're seeing a lot of those jobs moved out. And so people are going to realize that it's really important to learn a technical skill and be able to constantly adapt to an environment like the one we have, because those jobs eventually will also go elsewhere, and we'll have to have even newer advances to be able to replace those. But that's what creates a lot of the uncertainty right now, is because so many people aren't really trained to think that way and to work that way, and certainly the education system is going to have to change to adapt to it.
Bradford Jensen, what's wrong with Buy America?
I think it poses great risks, both to U.S. consumers and to the global economy. You know, if we're going to put up barriers and force companies and force the government in this country to buy from firms that would not otherwise be efficient, we're all going to pay the cost for that. And in addition, it will cause, collateral damage to firms in this country that are competitive. If you look at the Buy America provisions, I think it's caused a bit of consternation between Canada and the United States, where Canadian firms or even U.S. firms with Canadian operations were not allowed to bid on U.S. public works projects because some of their production occurred in Canada. So they weren't allowed to bid, taking, work away from an American firm. And then Canada has responded by saying that now Canadian public works projects, U.S. firms aren't eligible to bid. So, what we're going to do is we're going to force inefficient producers on both sides of the border to produce, when what we really want is the most efficient producers, regardless of where they're located, to produce goods and services.
Okay.
Otherwise, we all pay a higher price.
We've just about run out of time. I want to ask Ellen Hartnett one final question, and that is, have you heard anything on this program that gives you a reason to be more hopeful than you were 40 minutes ago?
Well, I kind of want to read Mr. Goodman's book. No, I kind of got a knot in my stomach about the first part, I think. But I also think that we are We are a great nation, and that we will pull ourselves out of this somehow. And everyone's going to have to give a little, and everyone's going to have to hurt a little. But if we can do it together and support each other, I think we will pull out of this. I still feel pretty positive about going forward,
okay.
I guess.
Well, Ellen Hartnett, thanks to you. Good luck to you and your husband. Thanks also to Professor Bradford Jensen at Georgetown University and the Peterson Institute for International Economy. Peter Goodman with the New York Times, the book Past Due, The End of Easy Money and the Renewal of the American Economy. And Sudeep Reddy, economics reporter for the Wall Street Journal.